So last week we started a new series looking at ways that we grieve God's grace, or that we don't get grace quite right. And we said that there's actually two ways to fall off the horse. You can fall off towards rule keeping, or you can fall off towards permissiveness. And really, in a sense, they're both equally bad. They're both equally grievous to God, and they can both equally, in some ways, in different ways, though, perhaps, lead us into danger and difficult situations. I want this morning to look at one direction in particular. What does it look like when we fall off the horse towards rule keeping? And I think it's as dangerous and bad as falling off the horse towards permissiveness, but I want to look at that this week, and next week look more at the permissiveness one. Part of the main point this morning is that falling off the horse towards rule-keeping, externally we might still be doing things that look good and fine, but internally our motives, our emotions, our heart is deeply wounded and changed and darkened. So I want us to look at this passage this morning that implicates all of that. So let me pray for us. Father, would you please pour out your Spirit upon us. Lord, we need your Spirit to enliven our ears so we can hear your voice. We need your Spirit to remove the shade over our eyes so we might see your word more clearly, we might see you more clearly. We ask, Lord, that you would do a good work in our midst this morning, that you would teach us from the word, Jesus' words, the parable, would instruct our hearts, but also would change our hearts, and that we would be transformed because of your loving kindness. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so Matthew, let me read the first part of this and explain things as we go along. Matthew 20. For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house. Remember last week? Kingdom of heaven was like a king who collected debts. So we have a similar kind of scenario set up. It's like a master of a house who went out early, about 6 a.m. in the morning, to hire laborers for his vineyard. He's hiring day laborers. It's probably harvest time. He needs to expand his workforce. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, denarius is your basic wage for a laborer for a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And then going out about the third hour, 9 a.m., he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And going to them, he said, "You go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you." So they went. Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, the master, did the same thing. And about the 11th hour, that's 5 p.m., the day knocks off at 6. 5 p.m., he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, "Why do you stand here idle all day?" And they said to him, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You go into the vineyard too." And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first." And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now when those who were hired first came, they thought that they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. One of the important things that's going on here is that Jesus tells this parable, and the whole parable, in one sense, twists on the master saying, pay the last ones first. Because if he paid the first ones first, they'd receive their denarius and they'd leave, probably. And then he'd pay the other ones and they would get the whole denarius too. And the word might eventually kind of leak out that these people that worked less than a whole day got a whole denarius. But this way, it's very explicit. This way, the master, in a sense, wants to confront them. He wants to create conflict. He wants to create an uproar here. And so he says, pay the ones that only worked an hour first. And then so that these guys that have worked the whole day will see what I'm doing and I can bring this issue to the head. So it's intentionally creating this conflict. So verse 11. So here's our first point, our terrible expressions of rule keeping. So verse 11 and 12. And on receiving it, this is the people that worked all day long, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us, who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." So I think we see here three responses of our terrible expressions of rule keeping. The first one is they grumble. Right? As soon as they receive their money, they're grumbling. What is grumbling? Grumbling is when you're indirectly or kind of not rationally just expressing your frustration to something. Right? It's not you go to someone and say, so like if your kids are grumbling, your kids will not be like, "Mom, I disagree. I'd like to ask you to reconsider the decision you just made based for the following reason. We didn't really watch TV for 6 hours. We only watched it for 5 hours today. And we didn't eat all the cookies. There's still some in the cup." Right? Grumbling is, "Mom, no, I can't do that. I want..." So grumbling is like non-rational. And it's kind of you're muttering things that you believe, but it's not civil. Right? You wouldn't go to someone and say what you grumbled to their face directly in polite conversation. So they're responding with this grumbling. Grumbling only occurs once in Matthew, but in Luke it shows up several times. And it's always about the Pharisees or people's response to who Jesus is eating with. Why is that? Because they have their little rule, their rules and their sense of if you eat with someone who's unholy, their unholiness washes upon you, and you become unholy or unclean. And so they grumble in Luke's gospel, they grumble at Jesus for who he eats with because Jesus is breaking their eating rules. The problem is they don't realize that in their sense, if you're holy and you eat with someone who's unholy, you become unholy perhaps. But in Jesus' case, Jesus is so holy that he can eat with anyone. And it doesn't at all malign his own holiness. Grumbling also shows up a lot in the Old Testament. It shows up in key places before and after God has acted in rescue and salvation. It shows up where people don't like what God is doing. We see a little bit of that in the first quote in the bulletin, Numbers 14, 2-4. And all of this is in the middle of the desert. All the people this is God has sent out the spies to spy out the promised land. And they've come back, and 10 of them have a bad report, and 2 of them have a good report. And what do the people say? All the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword?" They said to one another, "Let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt." So they're grumbling because God's intention and desire to bring them to the promised land, to bring them to full salvation, they don't like the way he's doing it. They don't like the faith that they're going to have to exercise in the midst of it. And so they grumble because they don't like God's plan. They'd rather have died in the desert. They'd rather go back to Egypt. So we see a multiplication of grumbling in different situations in the Old Testament, but it's interesting how Paul picks that up in 1 Corinthians 10. He says, "Now these things took place as an example for us, that we might not desire evil as they did." Look at this list. "Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it's written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did, and were destroyed by serpents. Nor grumble, as some of them did, and they were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as examples, but they're written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come." We probably think of grumbling as not that big a deal. But Paul puts grumbling in the narrative of the Old Testament right along with idolatry and sexual immorality and putting God to the test. So it's a serious expression of what's going on in our hearts, that we don't like God's rules. We like our, we prefer our rules much better, our approaches to things. And so one of our responses is to grumble. When do you grumble? What are the situations that cause you to mutter things under your breath? Not to confront someone directly, but to either in a low voice mumble something that they're like, what did you say? Oh, no. Or behind their back, or to have a story line playing through your head when you're alone. What are the rules that you oppose, right, that conflict other people's rules or God's rules, that conflict with yours, and your response is this discontentment, this this desire to die in the desert? What are the relations? Grumbling is really about rebellion. And Joshua in Numbers 14 brings that out. What are the relationships in which you tend to express rebellion against? Grumbling is, it's a serious expression of what's really happening in our heart when we cling to our rules and laws instead of being open to God or others. But then look what they say next. So they grumble, verse 11, verse 12. These last ones worked only an hour, and you have made them equal to us. That's an interesting way to put it. It didn't say, you've made us equal to them. You've made them equal to us. It's a statement about identity, right? You, by acting this way, we consider that you have, you've dragged us down. We are worth less than we think we should be worth because of how you've treated us. And who is it that you've treated this way? It's in verse 3. That's what these people that worked only started the job at 9 or at 12 or 3 or even 5 p.m. In verse 3 it says, and going about the third hour, he saw others standing idle. So that's the first set of people that didn't work the whole day. The last set of the people didn't work the whole day is in verse 5-6. Why do you stand here idle all day? Interesting, the text calls these people idle. In some ways, these people that work the whole day are saying, you, by doing this, Master, you are saying that our identity is the same as these idle people. And we're not idle like them. Like, I would never work a part day and take a whole day's salary. I'm not that kind of person. And you've lumped me into that group by paying the same amount. So it's an issue of idolatry, and it shows their disdain for these people that did not work the full day. It shows them sort of, don't you dare make us equal to them. But really, that's a very fragile way to build your identity. And they're building, how are they building their identity? They're building it based on their performance. Right? On I'm someone that's there at 6. And I'm there ready to work, and I'm one of the best workers, and you're going to pick me, and you're going to have a great day with me working for you. That's part of their identity. And I deserve my denarius, and I take it with pride. That's part of how they build who they are, on being able to match up to all the standards, being able to match up to their standards and other people's standards. So it's their own performance that becomes the measure for their identity. But that's actually a rather fragile way to put things. And in some ways they're saying, we are different than those idle people. And idle here can mean probably two things. One is they were lazy, perhaps, and got to the market late, the day worker market late. Maybe they had to do their own sharecropping field first, or maybe they got up late. But it also could mean people that are kind of shunned or excluded. Like, these are people that, maybe for no fault of their own, people don't choose to work in their field because they don't look very strong. or they don't look like the type of people that you want working in your vineyard. And so this group of everyone, the first people, they're building their identity on their performance and what they've done. What do you build your identity on? When is your identity challenged? When does something strike at its roots or its the branches of your self and your identity? What happens? What are you building it on? What does it take for you to start to wonder and feel I'm worthless or I'm worth less than I was last week? What does it take for you to be snubbed? If we build our identity on our performance, it can't help but sometime in our life to start to situations, words, comments to come to us, the job changes in the job market to shake the tree of our identity. What do we build ours on? The other thing that's going on here is comparison. In verse 12, these last ones worked only 1 hour. You've made them equal to us who bore the burden of the day and the scorching heat. Now, if it's summertime in the Middle East, it is very, very hot. The expats that work in the Middle East, they all leave in June. Because in July and August, it's 135 degrees. So it is very hot, but there's a comparison going on here between the people who work the whole day and these other people. We did the full job, and they didn't do the full job. And it's actually a comparison of our own happiness can't be full if other people got stuff they didn't deserve. Right? These people that didn't work the full day, they got the full day's pay. And somehow that act of generosity and grace to them undermines the joy that these all-day workers have. Somehow this comparison is something they can't let go of. Their joy is tied in with it tied into their meritocracy, what they deserve, but they also are begrudging when God is gracious to other people. But really, God's blessing is not about other people. God's blessing is not about us. Right? If God blesses someone else, it's not a statement about us. It's God's relationship with them. Right? And so, to ask ourselves, are we able to fully rejoice when God blesses someone else, some other Christian, in a way that he hasn't blessed us? Or is there a way in which our joy comes out of comparison? It's interesting that there's a few parallels between this parable and the parable of the talents. But in the parable of the talents, there's no comparison whatsoever to take. He says the master gives each servant a certain amount of money based on their ability. He gives one 5 and he makes it into 10. And he says, well done, good and faithful servant. He gives one 3 and makes it into 6. And he says, well done, good and faithful servant. There's no comparison of like, well, you did a good job, but you didn't quite do as good a job as this guy did. No, it's God's standard of faithfulness is individual towards each of us. And it's only the last one who denied God's character and denied his abilities that is called the wicked servant. So, and when we fall off the horse towards a rule-keeping mentality, there's a very strong way for us to start to grumble, and grumbling is a great sin that reveals the darkness in our heart. It's something we can build our identity on what we produce and perform and how we perform. And it can also lead us to our joy, our satisfaction, to be tied in with how God treats us compared to how God treats other people. Terrible expression. So what's the expression of God's character and heart? In verse 13 he says, but he replied to them, the master replies to them, friend, I am doing you no wrong. did you not agree with me for a denarius? The first thing we got to see about grace is that grace is not unrighteous. Grace is not unjust whatsoever. God was just, completely just and right with these people that worked all day long. They agreed on something and he paid them what they agreed. And so grace is not about letting everybody off the hook. Grace is not about injustice. It's not about cheap forgiveness. But God is righteous. God keeps his promises. God doesn't jip anybody. But it's interesting when he says, take what belongs to you and go. I think it's almost a matter of saying, if you want to live inside this world of my rights and what's mine and my rules, and you don't want to live in this world, my world of where I'm oftentimes gracious to people and give them so much more than they deserve, then you should take your rules and your worldview and your system and go. Because we can't coexist. Right? You're going to drag down everybody else over here. The scenario, ultimately, the scenario of living our lives based on rules and living our lives based on grace, they don't fit together. Rule keeping is a little bit of, at the end of the day, rule keeping is a few drops of egg yolk in the meringue. Right? It doesn't work at all. It's the whole thing collapses. Last week we talked a little bit about Les Mis and Jean Valjean. I wanted to give us a quote from Javert, the person that represents law. And just, I know some of you would be like, yeah, that's right up my alley. Some of you might be like, it's kind of wishy-washy and over emotional. But let me just say a couple of things about Les Mis to encourage you to think about it. One is, the music is fabulous. Because of two reasons. One, they didn't record it in the sound studio. They recorded it, the singing, while the person was acting. So Anne Hathaway's rendition will give you chills. Because she was acting it and singing it right then and there. The sound quality is not quite as good, but the emotion is intense. And then something else, the libretto. When the libretto has people singing on top of each other, like in a battle scene, two people passionately singing as if they're fighting, it's very, very intense. But also, Jean Valjean, he's not a witty guy. Right before he is released from prison, Javert says, go get me that flag. Well, the flag is attached to the mast of a ship, a giant ship that's been broken. Jean Valjean goes, doesn't undo the mat, undo the flag. He picks up the whole mast and drags it to Javert. Jean Valjean is this enormously strong and powerful man. And later he shows his mercy by he picks up a cart that has fallen on a man. And there's a time when Javert wants to arrest him and he says, I am a stronger man by far. You are not arresting me now because I have work to do. And it's this, it's not rebellion, but I'm using my strength for God's purpose right now. So that's just to encourage you that if you're a tough guy and you think lameness is not for you, but we see the difference between grace and law in Javert right before he commits suicide. Jean Valjean has Javert tied up, and he could have killed him easily. He's watching guard over him. But Jean Valjean cuts him loose, cuts his cords loose, and says, go, be free. He's merciful to him. And then Javert says, this third quote, all it would take was a flick of his knife. Vengeance was his, and he gave me back my life. Damned if I'll live in the dead of a thief. Damned if I'll yield at the end of a chase. I am the law, and the law is not mocked. I'll spit his pity right back in his face. There is nothing on earth that we share. It's either Jean Valjean or Javert. This is a man so tied up with law that he can't even have any grace come into his world. And instead of that, he says actually what the Israelites say. I'd rather die. And he cast himself into the swollen river Sin. So first, God is righteous, but he is also gracious alongside with that. It says, verse 14, take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give this last work as I give to you. Literally, it says, I desire. And we saw that word last week's passage. The servant did not desire to show mercy, but God does desire to show mercy. It's part of his character. And so it was his choice to give to these servants who didn't work the full day, but to give them the full amount. And he says, am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? How dare you cast your law of comparison, justice upon me? This is my money. I get to do what I want with it. God says, this is my grace and favor. I get to do what I desire with it. Am I not allowed to do what choose belongs to me? Would you begrudge my generosity? And so, instead of grumbling, what's the proper response? Look at verse 4. It's trust. And to those, he said about the third hour, you go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you. And so these guys are hired at 9 o'clock, not the full day. And the man says, the master says, I'll give you whatever's right. And they go. The only way they could go is if they trust this master to give them at least what's fair. He's going to give them more than what's fair. But they didn't sit there and say, well, how much are you actually going to give us? And negotiate with them. He said, I'll give you what is right. And they trusted him. And they went into the field of labor. They didn't have a guarantee of what they earned because they weren't starting the day at the very beginning. It doesn't say that they agreed. The first group agreed, all right, get a denarius, but we're going to obey. So instead of grumbling, this narrative of the scriptures calls us to trust. To trust God's rules, to trust God's situation that he brings into our life. Even when it confronts our laws and our rules and our desires, head on. Not to grumble and say, I'd rather live by my rules, but no, this is hard. I don't understand this, God. This frustrates me, but I will trust you. I'll walk with you in this path that you are leading me because I believe you're good. And I know you'll certainly never not jip me, and your grace will show up in some way, one way or another. And identity. Identity is not earned, but it's given. Imagine how these workers who didn't work the whole day received a denarius. How did they feel? How would you feel if you're shown this great undeserved favor? You're like, life is good. This is awesome. This is great. Our identity is built on what people do for us. Ultimately, what God does for us. Not what we do for ourselves. Not how much we achieve on our standard, but what other people do for us. Right? Little kids and your kids, they thrive when they know that they're deeply loved in the grace and the abundance of your family, and your household, not because they get 99s and 100s on every single test. So, we need to build our identity on what God has given us in his grace. And then comparison. God never sees us in comparison, and we should not see ourselves in comparison with other people. We shouldn't build our joy in comparison with other Christians. We shouldn't build our view of God and how much he blesses us versus blesses other people. We need to realize God's singular love for us and not his comparative love. He doesn't have a comparative love. There's a rich, deep, singular love for each of us. How does all this work? How does God hold together justice, not jipping anybody, and grace? I think it's ultimately that nobody started work at 6 a.m. Nobody. We all started work at Maybe some of us started work at 9. Maybe at 12 or 3. Some of us started at 5. Right? None of us can say, giving my full denarius, I deserve it. But there's one person who did start the day. Jesus started the day at 6. Jesus earned the full denarius. He worked under the full burden of the day. He bore the full burden of God's wrath for our sin. He bore the scorching heat of his just displeasure upon us. He took it all. And he took it willingly and intentionally. Look at verse 17 to 19. Right. Connected to this passage. As Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside. And on the way, he said to them, "See, we're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes. They will condemn him to death, deliver him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified, and will be raised on the third day." The word mocked there means played with. Flogged and crucified. But Jesus bore the full weight of the day. But then he didn't look down upon us who didn't work the full day. Rather, he's the true first worker, the first one, and he shared with us the vast blessings that he earned in our stead. He took our sin upon himself. He gave us his righteousness. He rose victorious on the third day to share his righteousness with us. He's completely opposite to these first ones. He has no disdain for us. He calls us into his family and he shares his great wealth with us. So, for those of us that are seeking to follow Jesus, who follow Jesus, it's the gospel that will help shed the darkness in our heart that comes from when we fall off the horse to the law side. But also, it's the gospel that makes a way for everyone to come. Right? Even the idle ones can come into God's family because of God's grace. The ones that were lazy and didn't get up in time. The ones that society had shunned, and for no reason of their own, because of just geography or genetics, they can't compete. They can't make it up the meritocracy ladder. God's grace includes that. There's no other philosophy or concept in the world that is as inclusive of those who screw up their life or those that can't compete. God's grace. So let's rejoice in God's grace and seek to learn how to apply it to our hearts and the situations that will show up this week.